It's good to be back with you. Still brightish there in Salford, in Greater Manchester. Good to be alive. Right, let's introduce my guest this hour. You don't need to be told about him. Great reporter, great writer, great broadcaster. The host of The Politics Show on BCFM. Former BBC journalist. Well-travelled man, as well-travelled a man as has ever appeared on this radio programme. To shoot the breeze with us for the next 30 minutes or thereabouts on some of the biggest stories of the week thus far. Always a pleasure to welcome back to the programme our friend Tony Gosling. Tony, welcome back, mate. Thanks for coming on. How are you?
Hi there, Richie. Thank you for inviting me on again.
I wanted to ask you this straight off the bat. Really interesting story today about this guy, Andrew Sabisky, who was one of the weirdos and misfits hired by Dominic Cummings as an advisor to number 10 Downing Street.
A very far-right one, isn't he?
Yes, well, allegedly, and some of the things
he quite clearly is.
Well, let me ask the question, before I shut up and get out of your way, let me ask the question I wanted to ask. Because this guy Sabisky quit yesterday. There has been comments today from people like Kwasi Kwarteng, who is a business minister in the government, that the guy should have been fired, that remarks he made in the past were racist and totally unacceptable. He's apparently suggested in the past that if you looked at IQs in the United States, that black people would have, they wouldn't score as well as white people. That's patently racist. If he said that and meant it, I don't know if the guy was trying to wind people up or try to get some sort of a conversation going. But the question I wanted to ask you is this guy, if this guy is a genuine racist, and he probably is he not, Tony, is he not really kind of more, is this not indicative of the mindset of people like Dominic Cummings, of people like Boris Johnson, of people like Jacob Rees-Mogg?
Okay, look, in a nutshell, this guy got caught. I think they'd be absolutely happy to have a far-right eugenic nutcase working in number 10.
Yeah.
So long as he hadn't actually been caught out by having his previous tweets on social media stuck in all the newspapers. So that's the way these sort of things work. They want to obviously, and as part of the recruitment process, they're asking him about his views, they're asking about his credentials, his qualifications, all that sort of thing. And, you know, he would almost certainly have been... So what is he supposed to be? A super forecaster, that's what I've said, which really means here's someone that is like almost like a sort of pagan fortune teller, someone who can divine the future. Now, that is really something which, we used to call it insider dealing.
Yeah.
So it's not just the idea that someone can look at the future and project it because they're looking at trends, you know, a bit like a weather forecaster or something. No, a lot of this knowledge and information comes from inside sources nowadays. And, of course, you can make a lot of money through getting that sort of information. And although the city and other big investors employ people like him to look at future trends, where banks are going to be investing in the future, which of course is a conscious decision. It's not like the weather, you know, those things are directed. And I think that's why he's been caught out. And they'd like to have the far right in these positions because they are, shall we say, they're less likely to have a moral conscience than, you know, to look at society as something that needs to be just for everybody than your average Joe in the street. I think that's simply it. And that this is the contrast you will not see made in the mass media, is the linkage between the financial forecasting system, which effectively for many years has been known as, you know, in many cases fraudulent, where someone says, next week I'm going to be investing in this, or next week we're going to be doing that, and maybe the share price is going to collapse. For example, with, you know, things like Thomas Cook, you know, so there would be insiders that knew that that was going to collapse and could therefore bet on it. And this is the kind of guy he is, I think. And it's quite clear he's into eugenics. I don't know, there's no doubt about that from what he's been tweeting in the past. And that's why they like these sorts of people, is because they have no real moral conscience and they are just simply there to be conduits in between government and big investors and the criminals in the City of London. So that's why he's in there. And good riddance to him and anybody else that's from a similar ilk.
I was, I do a live stream in the mornings. It's a nonsense, really, just looking through the newspapers on YouTube. And I've been around, like yourself, quite a few years. And it seems to me that these opinions are typical of this kind of elitist toff like this guy. And again, I mentioned Johnson, David Cameron, George Osborne. These are the sorts of things they believe, right? That we, the plebs or, I don't know, or the citizens, are not as worthy. We're less human than them. We're not as intelligent. We're there to be kind of traded around.
Well, this is certainly the way they see it, Richie. Yeah, I mean, I think they do look down on the mass of the population. They see us as the useless eaters, the herd, the masses, to be manipulated. I mean, I think we're increasingly seeing that sort of attitude in the mass media too. We know it started many years ago, but then we had in 2003 the whole weapons of mass destruction propaganda wave, you know, which few people actually believed it. But, you know, there's a lot, some people that did. And, of course, it gave legitimacy to the illegal invasion of Iraq. So there is a lot of this sort of thinking, I think, in elite circles. The masses are just a bunch of idiots, and they just need to be steered in the right direction, and they'll do our bidding.
And they'll do whatever we want. Thisweek.org.uk to find out more about Tony, if it's the very first time you're hearing him. It's unlikely. But thisweek.org.uk, the politics show. I'm very interested in this idea of, I mean, the guy wrote these posts on social media. And I've often talked on the program to our listeners and said to them, look, be very careful in the future. You know, if you're planning on changing your job or if you're planning on getting a job, be careful about your social media history. I don't think I've got any outright racists listening to me who believe that black people are stupid or that, you know, that Jews are an evil race. I don't think I've got those types of listeners. But I say, look, be careful about social media. Now, on to social media. I think this is one of the biggest stories of the year. The reaction to the death, the tragic death of a talented young woman called Caroline Flack, whom I didn't know too much about until I started following this story in the last couple of days. She seemed to be a very charismatic television presenter with a lot going for her. Had a few problems, but then don't we all. Was in a domestic with a boyfriend who did not want to pursue this. And the police did inexplicably, they did want to pursue it. Well, maybe not inexplicably. We might argue about that, me and you, in a minute. Anyway, tragically, the lady took her life. And the smart money might be on the fact that she was dreading the court case that was inevitable in the next couple of weeks and that she wasn't doing very well. God love the woman. But now we're being told that social media needs to be changed, that we need now to be identifiable online, that nobody can go online anymore and use a pseudonym or a pen name to enter into discussions. That's not good enough. We need to stop the trolling of people, famous people or anybody else. Caroline Flack's death proves that. And I worry about that, Tony, and that's why I said it might be one of the biggest stories of the year, because I think they fundamentally want to change the internet anyway. And they're using things like what happened to Caroline Flack to justify it. What do you think?
Well, what do you think killed her, really?
It would be dreadful for me to speculate because I don't know the woman. But I believe... Go ahead.
I would suggest antidepressants. Because she just recently come back on antidepressants after, I don't know if you read it, it was a whole confessional that she did December last year, Caroline, saying how weird the antidepressants have made her feel. One of the things it actually says on the packet of some of these antidepressants, I'm not sure what she was on, obviously, there are several different types, is that if you come back, in the initial stages of taking those antidepressants, they can make you suicidal. So let's just have a little look at the whole idea of antidepressants. What's going on here? I mean, a personal experience I've had with friends of mine who've been on these is they do not antidepress you. They make you suicidal. Effectively, what they're doing is they're kind of just shutting down your brain function, shutting down your soul, if you want. And this can be extremely difficult for somebody. And in fact, I would say steer well clear of these things. They're not going to necessarily antidepress you. They might kill you.
Yeah.
And these sorts of warnings, it's not just me saying this. If you look on the little bit of paper that you get inside the packet, there it is. May induce suicidal thoughts. This sort of thing is on there. And it looks to me as if what may have happened is that she certainly was on them at the time that she killed herself. was re-prescribed these recently. Of course, the obvious reason why her boyfriend didn't want to pursue the prosecution is because he may well have believed that it was her mental condition that was causing these, you know, very strong reactions from her, and that she wasn't actually a criminal. She was a victim of antidepressants. So that's the way this story looks to me. And that, of course, is a perfect excuse to divert any media attention away from the big pharma and the drug industry, which is killing, by the way, millions of people every year in a rather Dr. Mengele-style fashion. Many of these drugs are hideous. They have a hideous effect on people's personality and behavior and are highly, highly addictive. You know, what happens, the perversity of this, Richie, is the withdrawal symptoms from antidepressants and antipsychotic drugs can actually make things worse for the person as they come off the drugs. And what happens is the psychiatrist then prescribe a higher dose of the drug. So that's how perverse the whole situation is with these drugs. And I think this is the real story behind Caroline Flack. And of course, they don't want to take any flack, shall we say, at the pharmaceutical industry. So they just divert the story into the usual suspects, which is the legitimate comment on social media, which is polluted, of course, by hundreds of thousands of internet trolls who are sitting in a little office somewhere paid by somebody, possibly the drug companies, to just poison a debate and discussion. And yet those comments are used on the news as if they're from legitimate people, which, of course, they're not. So that's my take on the horrific and very sad.
This is amazing now. Hang on. This is incredible. I'm going to segue. I didn't, I heard you loud and clear there when you said trolls possibly paid by Big Pharma. We're going to go down that avenue now in a second. Hang on. Tony Gosling is our guest. Thisweek.org.uk, The Politics Show, one of the last journalists standing in the UK today. Now, I'm not saying that because I'm not kissing your arse, pal. It's a fact. Now, when I read that she was on antidepressants, of course, my monobrow Tony. I don't have eyebrows. I have a monobrow these days. I don't take care of my personal hygiene. At least my facial personal hygiene anyway. And my eyebrows raised because, yes, you and I have been speaking. I've been lucky enough to have you as a guest for many years. And we've often talked about shootings and various things. And we learn later on antidepressants were being taken by the perpetrator. Like you, my eyebrows were raised on that point. Like you, I agreed the boyfriend didn't want to pursue because he might have felt it was out of character. Now, the police might say, hey, listen, lads, if the shoe was on the other foot, we might not be inclined to so quickly, you know, like if the shoe was on the other foot and a woman had been battered, punched, or had a lampshade or a lamp broken off her head, and she said, no, I don't want to pursue it, it's just a domestic, the police might say, we would be hammered if we didn't pursue it. Feminists would be up in arms, right?
I don't think that's the case at all. I don't think there's any point in really trying to genderize any kind of like domestic fighting and, you know, that, those sorts of crimes that take place. The fact is though, Richie, think about it. If there'd been a trial of Caroline, you know, an assault trial, it's quite feasible that the pharmaceutical industry might have been called to give evidence in literally prime time television, saying, you know, can you please explain why your so-called antidepressant drugs cause this addictive effect and cause this potential suicidal extreme aggression, all these symptoms? Can you please explain why the, and maybe even NICE or one of these regulators been asked to explain why these are considered safe? I mean, you know, this is... as far as I can see, with antidepressants and antipsychotic drugs particularly, there's lots of drugs this goes for, is that you're effectively dealing here with a kind of criminal industry. These drugs I don't think should be available. It's almost like they're experimenting, doing live experiments on human beings. It's like, you know, it's like a kind of concentration camp doctor experiment that many of these people who are on these drugs have. And that's personal experience of personal friends of mine who've been adversely affected, almost 100% adversely affected by these antidepressants.
Tony, my better half, Caroline, who gets a regular mention on the programme, won't mind me telling this story because it's pertinent. When we left Spain after being there for 9 years, we went to London because I got a gig there. And we moved to London, we moved to North Wembley, which is a boil on the arsehole of the earth, North Wembley. It's dreadful. It's one of the worst places in the world to live. And I was basically missing from...
It's not as bad as Sunderland.
Don't even go there. We're going to start getting abuse now from people all over the country. Sunderland. I've never been to Sunderland, but Sunderland even, but we're in Wembley. I've basically left home crack of dawn. I'm not coming home till late in the night time. It's a horrible place. And she's an accountant. She's a very talented woman and she's finding her feet and she's looking at work. And she registers at the local NHS, as I did at the time. And she's in there, and she's knackered. It's been a very difficult move from Spain. She's lost a little bit of weight, and she's a little bit fed up in herself, as I was at the time, because it's a massive shift. Swear to God. Within a couple of minutes of meeting a doctor, she was offered Xanax. I swear to God. Now, she balked at this. She's like, what? Are you mad? There's nothing wrong with me. I'm not depressed. I'm trying to acclimatise to a fucking shithole, she said, in her wonderful French accent. I don't need Xanax. They couldn't wait to give her antidepressants. I've had it as well. I've been to a GP in Fallowfield in Manchester. I know you know Fallowfield well, University of Manchester District. I went to a GP. You look tired, Mr. Allen. I am tired. I'm working like a lunatic. Do you want sleeping tablets? No, I don't. Thanks. It's insane, Tony. It's insane how easy it is to get them and how quickly they push them on.
It isn't insane when it comes to making money because, of course, these are all paid for through the National Health Service, through the government, and the drug companies particularly like it when they've produced something which is addictive. So you need to keep taking this. Otherwise, if you stop taking it, you feel like you're like a spinning top. You can hardly stand up straight. Your head won't stand still. And so you take another pill. So, I mean, I think that there is a real case here for something like a Royal Commission or certainly a serious inquiry into stopping the prescription of these drugs. And, I mean, there are others, but these specifically we're talking about antipsychotics, antidepressants, to stop people being subjected to this addictive drug. It's just about money. It may seem insane a decision for a doctor to make. If you look at what's on the side effects list and the actual effect of the drug, but what it means is the person doesn't necessarily keep coming back to the doctor with the same problem because the brain has been switched off effectively. And it's a chemical cosh. It's a way of parking the problem, and it's a totally inhumane way of dealing with whatever the legitimate reason is that's caused the depression or the difficulties that the person's having.
Well said. Tony Gosling is our guest. Now, this is why I think the whole social media thing is going to be one of the biggest stories of the year. It's always been my belief that we would be induced, we would be kind of kettled on the internet. And by we, I mean the Earth population, every man, woman and child old enough to have a computer or whatever, that we would, the internet would become an umbilical cord. We can't live without it. In today's monologue, I talked about how we have to use it, whether we like it or not. We're on there all the time. We shop there. We order our food there. We socialize there. You cannot get a job in 2020 without having a social media profile. Would you believe, Tony? I've canvassed a few recruitment people in different parts of the world who are well known in recruitment. In Spain, people I used to know. And they said, yes, candidates will not be progressed unless they have a social media account. Anyway, here's my point, long-winded though it might be. They've gotten us addicted to, not addicted, they've connected us to the internet. Now they're saying that each and every one of us must be identifiable online. Our name, our real name and our location. Now you talked there a minute ago about Big Pharma maybe paying trolls to drive people mad. And I don't think that's fanciful. I think you're onto something there, my friend. I think you really are. But at the same time, it's a terrible thing if people are compelled from now on in, or in the near future, to, you can't access Instagram, social media, Twitter or Facebook, or you can't access Google unless you're using your real name and you can be identified. I believe that's the agenda, Tony, and I believe that is full-scale lockdown. That's a virtual prison. What say you?
Well, okay, so I think that what is coming is some sort of a digital identity tag.
Yeah.
Whether it's a physical thing that you have to put on your computer, like an RFID chip or something, this is definitely the way they're going. So they're trying to force everybody onto using online banking, this sort of thing. In fact, they're using financial inducements to do all that, saying, like, for example, a friend of mine was saying that he has to pay £6 for every electricity bill that he gets through the post now. Well, obviously, this is a fraud. That doesn't cost them £6 to put a bill in the post. And they're trying to do everything they can to drive us towards this digital, you know, we're almost there, really, aren't we, with the digital microchip money. You know, this idea of the mark of the beast, the microchip in the hand that you just wave next to something to pay for it. We're there with contactless. But the thing is that everything is trying to push us towards that, introducing things like charges for using old-fashioned checks and postal orders. That's where we're being slowly herded. And I think that's the way they do these things. But look, going on to your points about social networking and how to try and stay and keep your job, because that's one of the main things. If you're chit-chatting away on social media, you're going to have to be constantly thinking, well, ooh, do I dare say that? Because if I say that, then actually someone at my employer might sack me. In fact, this has happened, you know, to thousands of people. Is someone has made a complaint, or even a manager has seen what somebody said about something that's happened at work that they don't think it's appropriate to share, and they've just been sacked for it. So this is several years ago now. It must be about 8 years, 10 years ago, possibly. At the National Union of Journalists, we produced a guidance for journalists. So this is the whole point here is how to use social media without losing your job. There's all sorts of tips in there. I would suggest anybody that wants to be on social media and to share their views, frankly, without necessarily giving away who they are. So you can use an account with a different name. This is an obvious way to do things. But, you know, this is, I think, a great little guide we produced. It's called Social Networking Advisory Guidelines for Journalists. But it really works for anybody who doesn't want to lose their job, but wants to keep freedom of speech on the internet alive. And I think you and I both realise that that is crucial. As soon as freedom of speech on the internet is being crushed, of course, people like YouTube and Google are trying to do it. They're doing everything they can to do it, but of course, they're losing their monopoly or their market share by doing that, and they realise that. So they have to be a bit careful. They can't just close down everything they don't agree with. They have to be quite subtle about it. So, but the way to, I think, to keep people not scared to share their legitimate and their frank thoughts and ideas and humour, of course, as well, because satire and taking the mickey, making fun of the powerful figures is a great way to let off steam. I think it's a kind of a better therapy than antidepressants, if I might say so. Check out this social, it's called Social Networking Advisory Guidelines for Journalists, and you can download it and have a look at it. It's there for everyone to look at on the Brussels National Union of Journalists website. I mean, it was produced for the whole union, but the Brussels lot loved it, and they shared it all around the journalists up in the European Parliament, etc., a few years ago. And so anyone that's listening can download that if they want to and have a look. I think it's an invaluable document, and we put quite a lot of time and effort into it. So that's my little NUJ plug.
Yeah, too right, Tony. No, you can do that here, mate. You know that. Listen, on this whole self-censorship, which is really important you're talking about there, isn't it inevitable that we'll move towards a kind of a social crediting system of managing people, like we've seen in China? I know you and I have touched on this briefly in programs in the past. I know Black Mirror, that magnificent Charlie, what's the guy's name, Tony, Channel 4? It's not Charlie Booker, is it? Or Brooker, is it? I can't remember the guy's name.
Charlie Brooker.
It's fantastic. Black Mirror, amazing. Amazing show. And one of the episodes, of course, deals with this future, where your access to things, your access to life effectively, is determined by your score given by everybody else. And surely, again, it might sound
it's
to some
given
people...
given by a computer, surely, isn't it? AI that decides these things.
Eventually. Is that where you think it'll go, that artificial intelligence program?
Look, this is where they're trying to push us, but I don't believe any of this is inevitable. I really don't. I think there is a very strong and subtle push for all of this from the City of London, from the financial oligarchy, from the transhumanists, really. I mean, this is the philosophy, the modern fascist philosophy, which believes that a handful of oligarchs can behave like gods of ancient Egypt or of the classical era, you know, and just tell everyone how to behave. Alexander the Great, somebody like that. That's the sort of way they see themselves. That's actually a philosophy. It's a crystallized philosophy called transhumanism. That's definitely the way they think. And I just honestly be absolutely frank with you. I think they're going to push it too far, too fast, and I think they're going to fail. The question for me is how much chaos is going to be caused when they do fail. You know, I think, you know, it all depends really about how we get our heads around what they're up to before they actually try and pull a fast one on us. And they are going to try and push us in that direction. It's just at some point there's going to be, you know, pushback of various sorts, and that's already happening, I think, in some areas. There is resistance to all of this. It's just a question of how far and how fast they can do it.
Where's the resistance in, you and I are over 45, both of us, right? Where's the resistance in the generation behind us or the generation behind the generation behind us? There is no resistance. I tell you, and I'm not just arguing for the sake of it here. I see no resistance. I see a generation that is so addicted to technology that it seems to me that it is inevitable that it will succeed. It mightn't succeed with our generation and people older than us who might be horrified by what we see, but I see them queuing up, Tony, to get microchips. I see them queuing up to get wearable technology. I don't see that conversation. I spoke to a kid, Tony, again, go back to Fallowfield, about a year ago. I was in a shop and there was a kid paying contactless. And I'd seen the kid around. I knew he was attending the university. So I knew that I wouldn't be out of place in speaking to him and saying to him, what are you doing, son? You know, did you ever think about cash and the necessity of cash and the problems that might arise in our lives if we don't have access to cash? And the kid was good and he chatted with me for a few minutes. He said, I never thought of that. And I talked to him about the bail-ins in Cyprus. And of course he'd never heard of that. And I said, yes mate, you know, the government comes and tells you, oh, we owe a load of money to the European Central Bank. We're going to bail in. We're going to take some of your money from your account and you can't stop us. I see the younger generation's tone. I see them loving this, man. I don't see them moving away from it. I hope I'm wrong.
Well, I mean, you do tend to see things a bit as black and white. And
I do.
I see it as much more a grey in the middle. So yes, there are a whole load of people. There are millions of techno geeks who would just jump on the latest bit of technology and they want to be there, blah blah, you know, using a embedded microchip to use the skiing facilities in Switzerland or whatever. There are whole areas of Switzerland now that you can't access without one of these chips now, and it's the trendiest thing to do. Funny that the Swiss should be there first, isn't it? How about that? But the thing is, I've just spent the weekend with a whole bunch of people here in Bristol at something called the Land Justice Network conference. I would suggest maybe half the people I spoke to see the internet. You mention the internet to them and they put the kind of fingers crossed up at you, you know, stay away, you devil. You know, they want nothing to do with the internet. They're much more practical and they want to be a completely, they live off grid, many of these people, and they just don't want anything to do with that, modern techno. You know, they're not on the internet, many of them. And there is definitely a resistance out there to it, a sort of, if you could call it a Luddite mentality, technophobia, you could say in a more unkind fashion. But the Luddites, of course, in history, were saying this technology is killing us and we're going to destroy it. And they would turn up in the middle of the night and smash up and destroy and burn the factories, smash up, destroy and burn the farm machinery that was robbing them of their livelihoods. And that was a quite a legitimate protest, I would suggest. And there are similar people in a similar mindset today with this technology. So not everybody is jumping on the bandwagon as much as the owners of our world, the owners of this technology would like, because it's quite clear this technology, which is supposed to be liberating us, is actually enslaving us. Anybody that takes a step back and has a look at it, because of the ownership of it, it's not being shared.
Exactly.
It's not in any kind of collective ownership. It's owned by private individuals who are using it for private profit. And the most incredible thing is many of these people have got more billions or trillions of pounds to their name that they could ever spend, Richie.
Yeah.
They're just addicted to cash, addicted to power, addicted to money, and they use that money to buy up things like any kind of criticism of them. They'll buy lawyers to attack people. They'll buy mass media like Sky or anybody like that that starts criticizing. They will buy shares in it. They will start to manipulate the board. They'll buy banks, and they'll use that money to get whatever they want. And they're not interested in what other people want at all. So I think that there is a resistance to all of this change. As I said, at some point, they keep pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. There's going to be, it's going to all blow back in their face at some point in the future.
I hope you're right. I do take a more kind of shades of grey approach to most issues. But I'll give you the black and white thing. On this one, maybe I do see it in a bit of black and white. I just see it as a tidal wave. You know, I see the cashless society. We have bars now in Manchester won't take cash, Tony. It's happening in Sweden. It's happening all around the world. I'm a bit more pessimistic than you on that. Tony Gosling,
well,
I guess.
With public transport, a massive amount of public transport in Britain now is no cash.
No cash.
So you give the guy a £10 note, he won't let you on.
And won't let you on. And of course, the implications again for surveillance, right? I wanted to ask you because you dropped something in there. You mentioned Land Justice Conference, Bristol. What the hell is that? Sounds very interesting.
Oh, well, of course, as an Irishman, you will know about land and the power of it because it was the Irish Land League in the 1800s, yep. Or 1870s, 1880s, that really started the process of making Ireland less profitable for the British Empire. So they actually eventually had to give up with it. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of fighting involved after that. But the Land League was an incredibly successful organisation, and there's a film about it. I think it's called, it's to do with boycotting anyway. Captain Boycott, it's called. It's an old film. And it takes you through the whole boycotting process. And what they did is they boycotted these absentee landowners from Britain, from England, who owned the land and were rack renting and driving the Irish into poverty. The famine, of course, is history. I mean, although it wasn't really a famine, it was a forced starvation of the Irish population by the colonial Brits, English. And so that is really, I suppose, a modern version of this. I mean, most of the people who are living there are either off-grid or they're travellers in vehicles. And of course, we've seen with Boris Johnson, one of the first things he's done is to launch an attack on gypsies and travellers in Britain. Of course, many of them are Irish travellers. You know, there's different levels of different types of travellers as well. I mean, you know, they go there because there's lots of different sorts of travellers.
But
we saw in the 2010 government, Cameron's lot and Theresa May's lot, there was an enormous clampdown on squatting. So the squatters that were in empty homes, say a home has been empty for a year or a couple of years, squatters move in, claim squatters' rights. That's been there since literally the dawn of time. That's been a legal right to squat an empty property. They then brought in laws to stop you squatting residential property. So all these empty homes that people have bought up in central London, even if it's been empty for 10 years, you're not allowed to squat it anymore. So that was what the Cameron government so-called achieved in stopping people who have no roof over their head from actually achieving, you know, a decent night's sleep. And that, so now what they're doing is introducing laws against gypsies and travellers. So there's no way you can stop, you know, criminalising it effectively. So that's what they did with the residential squatting, criminalised it, and they're now getting the police to criminalise gypsies and travellers. That's what they're attempting to do. So hence, I think there was quite a lot of interest in Bristol because we've got lots and lots of people who do live in vehicles and caravans and things in Bristol who go around the festival scene in the summer to Glastonbury. There's loads of festivals, you know, literally something like 30, 40 festival scenes on the circuit, and many people winter out here in Bristol. So there was a lot of discussion really about how do we move towards a society where everyone has got a roof over their head, where house prices actually reflect the cost of building the house rather than the massively inflated cost of the land underneath it. And many of those people are extremely switched on to some of the things we are, Richie, about just how appalling many of our governments are and how they're behaving and how the financial and the corporate interests have really taken over most of the government policy now and have become a bit of a sham. So, you know, for many people, you're talking about the sort of the going against the tide. For what many people have done is they've decided, well, we're not going to try and swim against this tide. We're going to swim sideways and we're going to get to the bank of the river and we're going to climb up the side and watch. You know, so we're not interested in getting engaged with the way people are being swept and herded around. We're going to get out. And of course, the earth does provide for people like that. I mean, it's a free gift to mankind, the land. And if you can find yourself a little somewhere, whether you squat it or whether you buy it, lots and lots of people who are actually living off-grid now and making a go of it.
That's hugely, hugely interesting. And nobody will read anything about that anywhere in any newspaper in the UK.
Well, it hasn't been reported even here in the city, in our newspaper, even though it was a conference of something like 300 people all weekend.
And not a dicky bird, not a word in the newspapers. Isn't that so typical of the press in this country? I wanted to ask you before we...
They sort of love it that way, actually. Well, they quite like to be, you know, well, we don't care whether the press turn up or not. We're just, you know, this is just us talking to each other. I mean, I've been involved in this for a number of years. I used to go to something called the Global Eco Village Conference, which was a European-wide event. And that was one of the most incredible morale-boosting things I've ever... I mean, you used to go every year. And you meet people from all over Europe who are doing some of the most amazing, innovative stuff. I remember a whole bunch called Permalot. They were permaculture people from the Czech Republic building their own town, you know, because the planning laws let you do that. And they were building their own town from scratch and designing it themselves. A whole bunch of young people in Czech Republic. So it's a really, you know, there is a lot going on. None of it really is being reported by the mainstream press. They're all focused on their press releases, Richie, and you know that.
Well, of course. Well, heaven forbid that people find out what's going on and what is possible and start doing things for themselves. Heaven forbid. Just before... we go. Thanks for your time today, by the way. Couple of two final questions. One on your travels. We'll come to that in a second because you're off on your travels. We won't hear you for a couple of months on this show, which is...
You can still get me on Skype.
Well, that's great. Yeah. I mean, if you're happy to do that on your travels, all the better for us. But what about Jean Anne, who gets mentioned quite a bit, very, very important part of this radio programme, has asked me to put to you, what do you think about financial meltdowns in terms of surely we're going to have another one, quantitative easing and leveraging the debt that, you know, nations are find themselves mired in? This country is mired in billions, trillions of pounds worth of debt. It's not decreasing, it's increasing. Eventually, every 7 or 8 years, there's a collapse. Will we have another one? Will it be worse than the one before that? Are these the sort of things that you contemplate, T, when you're putting your shows together? A big financial collapse in the near future. What do you think?
Well, look, this is going back to Andrew Sabisky territory, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, this guy from Downing Street. Because the financial system is going to crash the economy at a moment which is convenient for itself. And it's also, it will also make an absolute fortune when it happens because, of course, they will be able to buy up all these other industries, whichever, whatever collapses at tuppence halfpenny on the pound. So, I mean, yes, of course, if you look at it, I mean, the best article I've seen in the last few years, is I think it's £160 trillion debt overhang, says Mervyn King. It was in This Is Money, which is an offshoot of the Daily Mail. The former Bank of England governor, Mervyn King, is one of the most solid characters you'll find. He was okay responsible for the 2008 financial bailouts, right? But, you know, you have to wonder, I mean, if they had allowed banks to collapse then, what would have been the effect? I mean, he decided, rightly or wrongly, that they were going to bail them out and they were going to allow the banks to continue to stop the cash points all freezing up for however many weeks, which would have been a little bit embarrassing and chaotic. But anyway, he's the son of a railway porter who was educated at the Worcester Grammar School, and he's very, very frank about the funding. For example, about Brexit, he said, well, it's going to have no effect whatsoever on the economy. Which I thought no one else is saying this.
Yeah.
He's saying it's irrelevant. The economy is going to do badly or well, despite Brexit, not because of it. You know, it's all a fiction. The idea that the economy is going to crash or something, which was, of course, is exactly what we heard when the vote happened itself. If you dare to vote for Brexit, the economy is going to crash. Well, did it? No, of course it didn't. Anyway, so he was saying all this sort of stuff. I think that is one of the key articles for me I would suggest your listener looks at from Mervyn King talking about the crash. And he's saying there's going to be another crash in the week because we haven't done anything to sort the system out from the last time. So he's one of those people, you might criticise him, of course, over 2008, what happened when he was Bank of England governor. But he's been on the side of the people, really, and come out and said, okay, guys, what we've done is we've learned that we needed to change this and this and this. I've asked for it to be done. I tried to get it done. They wouldn't do any of it. And now I'm saying because they didn't do it, these are going to be the consequences. So he's on the watchtower warning everybody, saying that this is coming. So it's not a paranoid thought or an idea, it's definitely coming. The question is when, and they will decide whenever. It's just like the 1929 crash. That was decided at the time by, I think it was something called Call Money that was, I remember seeing this in the Money Masters documentary, Bill Steele's documentary, many, many years ago, that what happened is the banks just stopped lending money on short overnight loans to the stock traders. And so, of course, they had to sell. And that caused the crash. So they orchestrated that 1929 crash, and they're going to orchestrate the next one.
And they'll orchestrate the next one. Before we go, where are you off to for 2 months? Where will you be?
Well, Vancouver, New Zealand. I was going to go via Hong Kong, Richie, actually.
Where are you, T? Just to see how the land is lying there.
I decided to swap routes, so we're going the other way, in fact. So going to spend 6 weeks in New Zealand, so that's where I'm off to. And it might be difficult to speak to you, I'm sure we can manage something.
Yeah, we will, mate. Thanks for your time today. Fascinating. We could have talked
about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning or something over there.
Well, I won't expect you to get up at 4 or 5, and we can facilitate a pre-record if necessary so that you're not getting up so early in the morning. Listen, mate, first of all, Godspeed to you on your travels. All the best. And
thank you.
I hope we do catch up, and if we don't, we look forward to getting you back on.
Will say just one thing about the show, which is that we've got a bit of a... We're looking at this week at this... I mean, I would suggest everybody that can watch it, watches it. It's called Cold Case Hammarskjöld, and it's about the murder and the assassination of the UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld, Swedish guy, in 1961. He was flying down to in Africa trying to stop the big Western mining companies and the Western governments and MI6 and people like that assassinating African leaders, and to bring peace to that country, to enable Africa to be an independent continent, after colonialism. And the whole documentary it won the best documentary, although you would never know it. The BBC helped commission it, Richie, but they never actually plugged it when it was on. It was on late one Thursday night at the end of November. It was on the iPlayer for about a week, and then they took it off, so you can't watch it anymore. It's actually really difficult. You can see some clips from it. But anyway, we're going to be talking to one of the producers of that, who's because as often happens when you make a documentary like that, which is, I mean, it really, not to spoil it for people, but it's basically a far-right mercenary army that was operating for decades, some say even 150 years, in South Africa, which ordered, basically carried out an operation to kill the Secretary General of the United Nations. And this has really only fairly recently come out, because of incredible work by the Swedish journalists combined with a whole load of South African journalists who've been digging into this and finally stood the story up. But it's a tremendous documentary, and it even goes into the use by this same organization of AIDS to literally set up camps in Mozambique where they were deliberately injecting people with AIDS in order to make the virus spread because they were racist, coming back to our friend Andrew Sabisky, and they wanted to kill as many black people in the South of Africa as they possibly could using the human-made AIDS virus. So that's a whole other side to the story, which they weren't expecting when they went in to just investigate the death of the UN Secretary General.
Well, there's a million reasons to listen to the politics show on BCFM, mate. That's obviously one. That's going to be on Friday's programme, is it, this interview with
that's
this producer?
Right. We will, yeah.
Well, listen, we'll tweet out links to that. You tweet it out, T, and we'll retweet it. People have to hear that. And if you haven't checked out Tony's program, check it out anyway. I meant it when I said earlier on, it's one of the last truly great radio programs in this country, talking about things in a proper journalistic way, investigating things that nobody else is talking about in this country, thisweek.org.uk.
We're doing is we're deconstructing the New World Order's program for humanity in real time. I think that's one of the things we we try and do,
Well, you're doing it with BBC production values.
So much of what they're doing to us is bamboozling. We looked briefly, didn't we, this week at Big Pharma and the massive amount of money that they're making out of making people sick. And, we need to be deconstructing that. Someone's got to do it, Richie.
Absolutely, mate. Look, have a great time on your travels, right? Godspeed. Look after yourself. Thisweek.org.uk. for the interview with the producer of that BBC-funded documentary, part-funded, which has disappeared, basically, about Dag Hammarskjöld, the former UN Secretary General. Tony, thanks again, mate, for everything. I really appreciate it.
God bless, Rishi. Cheers.
You
Take
too,
care.
Mate. Bye for now. The terrific Tony Gosling, live on the Richie Allen radio show. Let me just reiterate, I mean, you heard Tony clearly there. Let me just tell you what he was talking about there at the very end. This is fascinating. And I knew nothing about this, like most things. Like most things, I know nothing about them, unless somebody tells me about them. Back in, this is going back 40, 50 years, the then UN Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld, was taking on Western imperialists and big mining companies and interests in Africa, and exposing them, and planning to get them out of there. And his plane was shot down by a mercenary outfit. This has only come to light, Tony said, in recent times. He's all over it. The documentary about this was part funded by the BBC. It was on BBC 4's Storyville. But the BBC didn't even promote their own documentary. And now it's on, I won't say it's unwatchable, you can't get it now. It's not on the BBC iPlayer. I don't know if you can get it, I don't know if it's on YouTube, but BBC 4 Storyville, the search for the truth behind the plane crash, the plane carrying the UN Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld. It's a 2-hour film, and it won Best Documentary at the Cannes Film Festival.